Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. And today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news.
We'll begin with today's release of the majority report from the House Intelligence Committee, which found that Trump, quote, personally and acting through agents within and outside of the U.S. government, solicited the interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, to benefit his re-election. And while not recommending articles upon which Trump should be impeached, the House Judiciary Committee will now evaluate the report for articles of impeachment against the president. Casey Michel, a writer, analyst, and investigative journalist who digs into topics ranging from kleptocracy and grand corruption to developments in the post-Soviet space and relations with the West, whose forthcoming book is Crossroads Asia, joins us. We'll discuss the contents of the report and assess whether its findings will overcome the partisan divisions and the Republican effort to once again blame everything Trump is guilty of on Hillary Clinton, who, according to the absurd talking points the GOP is parroting from Putin, apparently arranged with the FBI to place her server in Ukraine to hack into the DNC and her campaign manager Podesta's emails, then pass on the damaging contents to WikiLeaks so that she would cause herself to lose the election. Then, with a federal appeals court siding with House Democrats trying to obtain records of Trump's financial dealings with Deutsche Bank and Capital One, ordering the two banks to comply with House subpoenas in a prompt manner, we will speak with Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. A former staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and is currently chair of the Tax Justice Network USA. We will discuss Trump's likely move to appeal to the Supreme Court in the hope of running out the clock. Then finally, we'll speak with Nina Burley, a national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, was a New York Times bestseller, and her latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. She joins us to discuss the royal family's deepening disgrace following Monday's airing of the BBC documentary featuring the women who, as girls, were trafficked for sex with Prince Andrew by Jeffrey Epstein, about which, when asked at the NATO summit, Trump lied, claiming he did not know Prince Andrew, even though there are many videos of them together and even pictures of Trump and Prince Andrew with Epstein in the background. And joining us now is Casey Michel, who is a writer, analyst, and investigative journalist on topics ranging from kleptocracy and grand corruption to developments in the post-Soviet space and relations with the West. His articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Politico, The Washington Post, Talking Points Memo, The Moscow Times, and Business Insider. And he recently authored a report with the Hudson Institute on the U.S.'s transition into a global offshore finance haven. And his forthcoming book is Crossroads Asia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Casey Michel.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks, Casey. And I understand you spent the day reading the report. You'd previously read the minority report from the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee, but the majority report from the House Intelligence Committee was delivered today to the House Judiciary Committee to evaluate for articles of impeachment against President Trump. But from what I understand, the main takeaway was, just quoting from the report, that President Trump personally and acting through agents within and outside of the U.S. government solicited the interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, to benefit his re-election. Is that enough to penetrate the great divide in this country?
Well, Ian, I mean, that's a great question, and that's really been the million-dollar question ever since the discussions about potential impeachment and then obviously actual impeachment hearings got going. As it pertains to whether or not this report in and of itself, the summarizations, the compilations, the quotes, the revelations, everything within that we saw come out today will be enough to move the needle as it pertains to a potential conviction in the Senate, it's tough to say right now. The answer the kind of the presumption behind that is that it's not going to be enough in and of itself. That is not to say that a potential conviction won't happen in the Senate once the House votes on impeachment itself and presumably votes for impeachment. But this report in and of itself will presumably not be enough to move the needle as it pertains to getting the necessary two-thirds number of the Senate itself to vote for conviction. All that to say, though, even though this this doesn't necessarily put everyone over the edge or put potential impeachment over the edge as it pertains to actually getting those necessary votes in the Senate. Nonetheless, this is a historic document. And to an extent, what we saw yesterday with the Republican report was also technically historic insofar as it was the greatest and most vociferous defense we've seen thus far of the president's really unprecedented behavior. What we saw today from the Democrats was a compilation, again, of all that we've learned about his truly breathtaking, the depths to which he went to assure himself of trying to get reelected in 2020 via these means of foreign interference, via these unprecedented lengths to which he went to pressure a foreign government to investigate a political rival. So even though all that is to say, even though this doesn't necessarily today, this report, get us to the necessary two-thirds in the Senate to get the conviction, it is nonetheless a historic document that historians will be poring over for years and years to come.
And the report also lays out what, quoting again, an unprecedented campaign of obstruction of this impeachment inquiry. And it concludes by saying the damage to our system of checks and balances and to the balance of power within our three branches of government will be long-lasting and potentially irrevocable if the president's ability to stonewall Congress goes unchecked. Any future president will feel empowered to resist an investigation into their own wrongdoing, malfeasance, or corruption, and the result will be a nation at far greater risk of all three. So that is an appeal, I guess, to the institution of the Congress as a checks and balance. Is that going to resonate? In other words, is the partisanship so deep and so, you know, intense that none of these Republicans, particularly in the Senate, will look beyond the immediate election and not realize the long-term damage to the ability of the Congress to conduct oversight in the future?
Yeah, no, I mean, Ian, again, where we are right now in the impeachment proceeding, where we are right now in terms of the publishing of this report that we saw come out today, as it pertains to moving a potential handful of or significant number of Republicans in the Senate into the pro-conviction camp. Unfortunately, I don't think that this is going to get us there. But again, all of that is to say, even though that may not happen, even though Trump may not be removed, even though there may not be the two-thirds in the Senate that eventually vote for conviction and removal, at the end of the day, I mean, quite frankly, despite the partisanship, despite the rancor, despite the presumed outcome that we're looking at already, at the end of the day, this was nonetheless the right move and the necessary move for the Democrats to take. And just to kind of pull back the lens a little bit, again, what we've seen from Trump, what we've learned from Trump, and I know, Ian, you and I have spoken about this in the past, what we have been exposed to through the reports, through the testimonies, through the leaks, through the documents, is that President Trump is the first president, the first sitting president in American history to pressure a foreign government to investigate a political rival. He's the first one to ever do that of the 45 that we have had. All that is to say, that also happened in the context of doing it against Ukraine, which is in a hot war with Russia, doing it with congressionally mandated aid. I mean, there's any number of other issues beyond that. But at the end of the day, this was completely impeachable behavior. It was completely unprecedented behavior. And this move toward impeachment, even though it may not end up in the removal of Trump himself, was nonetheless a reinforcement of a very bright red line and a reinforcement of certain congressional prerogatives and basic democratic guardrails that even if the Republicans right now don't see that, this was a necessary step because it was just a breathtakingly impeachable series of decisions and series of moves from Trump, from his sycophants, and from, as we learned about in the reports today, some of the other members of the Republican House themselves, most especially Devin Nunes, the representative from California. And maybe we'll talk about him a little bit later. But again, this gets back to the historic nature of the document and the actual moral and political thrust of necessity for impeachment, even if it doesn't end in his removal.
Well, let's talk about Devin Nunes, because the House Intelligence Committee report does disclose new contacts between Devin Nunes, the minority chair, and President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. It shows how Nunes essentially gathered up this propaganda that was put forth by John Solomon, smearing the U.S. ambassador of Ukraine, Marie Ivanovich, who recently testified, of course, and Solomon was talking to this dreadful crook, the former prosecutor general in Ukraine, Viktor Shokin, who was running a racket. Basically, he was saying to shaking down all the rich and powerful people and corporations by saying, you know, just pay me money and I won't investigate you and send money to my Cyprus bank account. Or he would say to them, pay me and I'll investigate your commercial rivals, etc. So he was spectacularly corrupt, and the Biden senior, along with the rest of the Europeans, finally managed to remove him. But Nunez met with this creep, who, by the way, Donald Trump, in the transcript of the conversation that he had with Ukraine's President Zelensky, talked about this great prosecutor who was so wrongly fired. I mean, this is the part of it that's so extraordinary. There's so many sleazy bagmen involved in this. I don't understand why people can't see the fingerprints, the kind of oily ooze of corruption that just swamps this whole seedy story.
Yeah, Ian, you're exactly right. And I think the phrase, so many sleazy bagmen, really sums it up so well. This isn't just the individuals that have gotten the headlines, but it's also the people that they have been hiring, who have been working on their behalf. You know, one of the individuals you just mentioned in there was John Solomon, who is this self-proclaimed investigative journalist who used to work at an outlet called The Hill, no longer does. While he was there, he was running these opinion columns that were effectively laundering and not even doing the basic fact-checking of some of these, again, crooked post-Soviet figures out of Ukraine. Just so happens that Solomon's lawyers are also the lawyers for an oligarch based in Vienna named Dmitry Firtash, who just so happens to have a very public grudge against Joe Biden, who just so happened to hire Lev Parnas as a translator, who just so happened to work with Rudy Giuliani, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on and on and on. There is this network, this nexus of, as you said, oily, sleazy bagmen and individuals and voices, all of whom are pushing this narrative, are trying to unearth this so-called dirt against Joe Biden, are trying to whisper in Donald Trump's ears about these conspiracies, about these malefactors, and about these networks that are trying to, in certain instances, interfere in the U.S. against Trump, or are trying to propel Joe Biden, or are trying to protect Joe Biden, et cetera, et cetera. And here we have, as we learned today, Nunes, who there had been reports previously, had met with Parnas himself, had denied it, had said, I don't know him, I have nothing to do with him. Well, lo and behold, some of the call records that came out today show that Nunes was in direct communication, not only with Giuliani and not only with others, but also Parnas himself. Now, we don't know the content of those conversations. We don't know exactly what they were talking about or what was different between one conversation and the other, but we do know that at the height of, or one of the peaks of, this push for investigations into Biden, Devin Nunes was as involved as anyone. He didn't, and that is to say, he didn't recuse himself from any of these hearings. He didn't reveal these conversations during any of the hearings over the past few weeks. It is one of the scummiest, sleaziest, most unethical developments of the entire series of impeachment hearings. I mean, it is just breathtaking the depths to which these pro-Trump voices are willing to go to defend the president's behavior, to defend this entire campaign, and to upend and block and stall any questions into it. Nunes fits right into it if he isn't taking a leading role anyway.
But how come the Republican Party has become an asset of Vladimir Putin's? They are parroting Putin's line. Recently, Putin made the remark that how great it is that they're finally investigating, they're no longer investigating Russian connections to the 2016 election. Now they're investigating Ukraine. We know from Fiona Hill's testimony that this is the whole purpose of Russian propaganda, is to switch attention away from them onto the poor, hapless Ukrainians who are under attack by Russia. So now you've got Senator Kennedy making an absolute fool of himself. Even Burr, who was considered a sober guy, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, he's joining in. Why are they all doing it? Why are they parroting Russian propaganda?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that they're not actually all doing it. We have folks like Kennedy, we have folks like Burr who are saying these things, but just today, Mitt Romney came out, who again has been something of an atypical voice within the Republican Party, saying, I have never seen any evidence in any of the hearings and any of the testimonies that indicates that Ukraine had anything to do with interference efforts or efforts to cover up Biden's supposed corruption, et cetera, et cetera. So what you have is, rather than a wholesale vociferous kind of base of support for Trump himself, you actually have these kind of splintering opposition voices within the Republican Party. You know, the question that I have is whether or not, when the rubber meets the road, they're actually going to have any kind of votes behind them. You know, is Mitt Romney going to say that, okay, I do stand up and I oppose the president's decisions to do these things and I support his removal? Or at the end of the day, is it simply rhetoric? You know, I think that one of the things Kennedy does so well, for instance, out of Louisiana, is he is so good at pandering. He is so good at speaking down to people. You know, this is an Oxford-educated, well-trained lawyer who, when he shows up at these rallies down in Louisiana, complains about the elites and the folks who don't pay attention and this and that and the other thing. And he puts on this complete facade over who he is. And I have to think that that's what he's doing when he says, oh, well, we also know that Ukraine meddled. We also know that Ukraine was the one that may have actually tried to interfere in 2016. I have to think that he's just simply pandering and he knows the truth, because, boy, if he's telling it like he actually believes it, if he's saying these things and he actually believes that Ukraine was the one that interfered in 2016, that's a lot scarier thought moving forward.
But if you pull back a little, and this is what I don't understand, why the Democrats, Schiff and any of them, and particularly Nadler, who's pretty useless, I think, why they can't make the simple point, and this may penetrate the Fox News bubble, that it doesn't make any sense that Hillary Clinton, in collusion with the FBI, put her server in Ukraine that was supposedly owned by a Ukrainian billionaire that doesn't exist, and then they hacked into her own emails, into Podesta's emails, into the DNC, and then they got all this damaging material against Hillary Clinton, which they then passed on to WikiLeaks to destroy her presidency and help elect Donald Trump. What? I mean, it makes no sense.
I mean, yeah, Ian, you're exactly right. And trying to extricate any kind of facts or logic from these kinds of conspiracy theories that have proliferated among Trump's base over the past few years, and frankly, even before, during the Obama years, is a fool's errand, and attempting to kind of delineate the types of, you know, factual inaccuracies or mistruths or misdirections within that is certainly a worthwhile pursuit, insofar as anything factual or highlighting any kind of fact-based analysis is a worthwhile pursuit. But for so many Americans that support Donald Trump through hell or high water, for so many of them, there is just no logic that you can lay upon them, that you can try to provide for them as it pertains to any kind of facts or realities or again, logic at the end of the day, that they will keep, that they will find, and that they will hold. And that's just the unfortunate truth. And I admire the people who try to do that, who try to right these ships. But I certainly don't have the energy for it. I mean, these are grown people who believe absolute idiocies, and I have no sympathy for them.
Well, then what will move the needle? The Republican report that you read basically sort of says, you know, that there's no there. And of course, all international relations, negotiations between presidents and other world leaders, they're all at the end of the day about quid pro quo. So, you know, what's the big deal? And of course, at the end of the day, they got their Javelin missiles and all this. We know what their arguments are. They're just going to stick to their arguments and basically, you know, say this is no big deal. So, and I'm not sure that this report, which will end up being an article of how many articles of impeachment, along with some of the Mueller stuff that they will, obstruction of justice that they'll probably throw in there. But unless they could get some sort of stuff that really resonates, like bribery and treason, and certainly bribery is very much a part of this Ukraine story, I don't see them grabbing the public in a way that's going to make this anything less than a predictable, you know, the Democrats impeach in the House and the Republicans exonerate him in the Senate. And then at the end of the day, Trump will say, what a huge waste of time.
Yeah, and he's perfectly free and willing to say that, absolutely. But at the end of the day, he's one of the very few presidents who will have been impeached by the House, he will always have that stain on his record. Now, how that reflects as it pertains to the 2020 election or Trump's reaction to a potential 2020 election loss, I don't know. I have no idea what to, I certainly didn't know how things would go in 2016, and I'd hardly be willing to predict how things go in 2020. Impeachment in and of itself in the U.S., you know, as somebody phrased it, it's a relatively low bar in the House and a relatively high bar in the Senate. That's the way that the framers designed it. And that's what we're seeing play out right now. It's what we saw play out in 1998 with Bill Clinton and what we're seeing play out with Donald Trump right now. Again, as it pertains to a potential removal from office, you know, there are a few things that I can foresee that would see something like that come to fruition. One is whether it's tapes or video or written directives from Trump explicitly outlining, I want X for Y. As it pertains to Biden in Ukraine, that is certainly a potential. If you get Giuliani up on a public stage, public testimony, and he goes completely off the rails, that is certainly something that would get the public's attention. If you get John Bolton on there and confirming everything that we know already about Donald Trump and his behavior, that is something that could move the needle itself. But again, where we are right now, it doesn't seem that there would be the numbers. And this points again to the kind of moral rot that has taken place among the Republican Party under Donald Trump, that they would be willing to countenance this behavior without continued public condemnation, continued consideration of removal from office. Because, you know, it's funny, at the end of the day, they removed Trump from office, fine. We have a President Pence. It's not as if it goes directly to Pelosi. It's not as if it goes back to Hillary Clinton. This is Mike Pence, who is everything that the Republican Party of the past 30, 40, 50 years has aspired to and would love to see in the White House. But again, at the end of the day, it points to the kind of moral degradation that the Republican Party under Trump and even previous to Trump has undergone. The continued threat to basic democratic underpinnings that this administration presents and the continued tools and willingness to use those tools that Trump has in his back pocket as it pertains to inviting foreign interference, as it pertains to pressuring foreign governments to investigate political rivals, as it pertains to threatening the basic health of our democracy moving forward. It's a perilous time, and I don't know how it ends. And I am, on the one hand, as a journalist, very much looking forward to seeing developments and covering developments. On the other hand, as an American, I'm very worried and concerned moving forward, especially as an American who has studied very closely post-Soviet and post-communist regimes and the types of tools and tactics authoritarian governments and leaders have used and utilized and perfected, and to see the kind of transference that we've seen take place into the American body politic over the past few years and presumably continuing moving forward is very concerning.
Well, Casey, Michelle, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Casey Michelle, who's a writer, analyst, and investigative journalist on topics ranging from kleptocracy and grand corruption to developments in the post-Soviet space and relations with the West. His articles have appeared in Foreign Policy, The Atlantic, Politico, The Washington Post, Talking Points Memo, The Moscow Times, and Business Insider. And he recently authored a report with the Hudson Institute on the United States' transition into a global offshore finance haven. And his forthcoming book is Crossroads Asia.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and has been a consultant to the United Nations Center on Transnational Corporations, the United Nations Office of Drug Control and Crime Prevention, and served as the chair of the Experts Group on International Asset Recovery. And currently he serves as the chair of the Tax Justice Network USA. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jack Blum.
Good to be talking to you.
Well, thank you, Jack. And so what do you make of the appeals court today, Federal Appeals Court, Second Circuit, siding with the House Democrats, trying to obtain records of Trump's financial dealings with Deutsche Bank and Capital One? They've ordered these two banks to comply with House subpoenas in a prompt manner. Is that going to happen?
Well, I think inevitably there's going to be an appeal to the Supreme Court by Trump and the people supporting Trump. The point that I would make is that the subpoena power of the Congress is extremely broad. And believe it or not, the principal source, legal source for that power goes back to the days of the House Un-American Activities Committee, where time and again, people who were called to testify claimed that they had no business calling them. The committee had no business calling them because it had no legitimate legislative purpose. And the courts ruled that that was really a decision for Congress. And please, we shouldn't be arguing that point. So there's a lot of precedent out there that says Congress has this authority and has this power. The problem here is the way this has been pursued by the Trump people, and what they're doing is playing a delaying game. The more appeals that are filed and the further it goes, the more time it takes. And the more time it takes, the more likely it is that whatever proceedings are going to happen in the Senate will happen before any of these discovery rules come to be effective. So the Congress won't have the information in time to use it in the actual impeachment. And that seems to me to be the point of the game.
But Donald Trump is resisting subpoenas across the board and forbidding his people from testifying. And it makes no sense on the surface that he won't allow anybody to go and defend himself, particularly his Secretary of State, his acting Chief of Staff, his Energy Secretary and former National Security Advisor.
That's obviously because he knows that their positions are indefensible and that if they actually tell the truth, his goose is cooked. So he just wants to keep them all away from testifying. His problem is that in the previous impeachment efforts, one of the major items on the table for reasons for impeachment is obstruction of justice, and that's exactly what he's doing. So I've been kind of amused, and I can't understand how the argument has withstood any kind of scrutiny. Here are the Trump people arguing that, oh, they haven't had a chance to produce evidence, haven't had a chance to produce witnesses, when in truth what they've been doing is withholding the witnesses and the evidence, and from people who you would say presumably, if there was a defense, would be on Trump's side. So that would be somebody like Pompeo, and they won't let him testify. Well, why is that? Understand Pompeo, he should be there defending the president. But it's obvious the president won't let him testify because if he testifies truthfully, the president's goose is cooked.
But this is what's so puzzling. The Trump supporters don't see that, and it seems so incredibly obvious. And at the end of the report that was handed over today by the House Intelligence Committee, the majority report, it concludes with a warning that if the president is able to get away with denying subpoenas and stonewalling like Trump is doing, then the effectiveness of the legislative branch to do oversight over the future will be eroded to the point that'll be meaningless, and this will have dire consequences.
That is exactly right. And the law, to the extent it's ever been tested, is that the subpoena power of the Congress is very broad, and the broad nature of that power has been used time and again against individuals and corporations, always upheld by the courts. The issue of subpoena power of Congress against government agencies has been an issue that nobody has wanted to send to a court. So typically, there's always a negotiated settlement. I've been involved in a few of those. And what happens is, once you get the vote in the Senate to issue the subpoena, the government agency involved caves and turns over at least a significant portion of what's been requested. So it kind of moots the argument, and everybody gets back to business. But if the proposition is that the government agencies can refuse absolutely to give information, the net result of it will be to completely negate Congress's power of oversight, investigation, and very important kinds of issues that Congress has had to investigate will never get looked at. So right now, there's a movie out called The Report, which goes into the report on torture, and this was by the CIA during the period of our war in Afghanistan and the people who were supposedly responsible for 9/11. And the report made clear that the U.S. government was involved systematically in torture. And that report was something the government very much did not want out, or at least the agencies didn't want out. And in the end, Congress got it out. And the report stands as a monument to why it's so important to have government oversight.
Well, again, it's extraordinary that the Republicans are not standing up for the institution of the Congress, of which they belong.
Well, what's even more astonishing is we would normally say the reason they're doing it is they're afraid of a political backlash that comes from the administration and the cutting off of campaign finance and a whole variety of other punishments. But there are any number of senators who are not up for re-election and won't be until Trump is gone. So what are they afraid of? And where is all of this fear and terror that they're exhibiting? I can't make any sense out of that. You would expect at least some of them would have the integrity to stand up for the institution. But apparently this is a lockstep proposition. And there are members of the Senate who really do care about the institution, Republican members, and they've just gone AWOL.
Well, Jack Blum, the minority report from the House Intelligence Committee, and by the way, its leader, Devin Nunes, is implicated in the report. He worked both with Giuliani and with this bagman, Lev Parnas, who was arrested at Dulles International, trying to get dirt on Biden. He was actively involved in the very stuff that Trump's accused of. But their basic argument is that, you know, quid pro quos go on all the time between presidents and foreign leaders. They always make deals. And furthermore, you know, testimony from a bunch of government bureaucrats, that doesn't count. They're employees of the government, and they should be doing what their boss tells them. Now,
there is so much evidence that you have to be deaf, dumb, and blind to accept that argument. The evidence is there in the form of testimony from Sondland. It's there in the form of testimony from the people who worked at NSC. This was a remarkable group of people who had the courage to stand up and say, no, this is nonsense. Now it's backed up by telephone records that show the backstairs dealing with Giuliani. How can you possibly argue then that everything was quite okay and it was normal business. And if it was normal business, well, for God's sakes, put all these people on. Let's have the Secretary of State explain it. Let's have the people from OMB, and remember, two of them resigned, step forward and say, yeah, we were working on evaluating Ukrainian corruption. In fact, the Defense Department did exactly that and said they were working on it and met the standards. So facts here don't seem to have any influence on the minority report, or for that matter, on what the minority is saying.
But isn't that the same as what happened with the Mueller report? The evidence of obstruction of justice was so great that I think over 1,000 former federal prosecutors said that this is one of the strongest cases they've ever seen.
Yes, exactly. Well, that of course, is why, since that worked, the people in the administration or the people surrounding Trump and advising him said, look, it worked last time, let's do it again. And it was a way that they blew off Congress. Now, at that point, Congress was much more nervous about taking it on. Now, it's such a clear-cut case, and it's understandable and clear-cut, whereas earlier you could obfuscate and double-talk your way around. Now, mind you, I don't think it stands, but at least there was a possibility to talk your way around it. And we had two other problems. One is Barr, who undercut the report as it was being published, and then Mueller himself, who really wasn't up to the task of testifying. He really didn't have a strong grip on the material in the report, and he didn't come across in a straightforward and a forceful way. And after watching his testimony, I came to believe that the reason everybody was willing to appoint him was they understood that he was really not quite up to it, and that if there was a report issued, he wouldn't stand up to them and wouldn't argue the case for the report, which might go against what they wanted. So he didn't. He just put some things forward, some facts forward. But by then, the report had been double-talked by the Attorney General, discredited by Trump, who said, oh, this couldn't be true, it isn't true, it's a witch hunt. And then you had Mueller himself, who really wasn't forceful in defending his work, and for that matter was so overly cautious that the story was obfuscated.
Well, Jack Blum, I thank you for your analysis, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jack Blum, a Washington lawyer who's an expert on white-collar financial crime and international tax evasion. He spent 14 years as a staff attorney with the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with more of Background Briefing on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nina Burley, who's a national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Burley.
Thank you, Ian.
So, Nina, there was a devastating documentary BBC played on Monday night in the UK, and it apparently it has deepened the disgrace that the royal family has been going through since Prince Andrew volunteered to do an interview with the BBC that, shall we say, did not go well. But now this has compounded it to the point where the British public really feel overwhelmingly that they were apparently Virginia Giuffre, is that how you pronounce her name? One of the young
women? Well, you know, in the CBS report on that doc, on the what happened with, you know, the interview with her in the UK, they pronounce her name two different ways, Giuffre and Giuffre.
Right.
I would say, as having lived in Italy, it's Giuffre, because that's the way you would pronounce it in it's an Italian name, I think, or a French name, right? Giuffre.
Right.
I think Italian.
Apparently she came.
But anyway, who knows?
She came across as being incredibly credible compared to Andrew, who was just either incredibly stupid or arrogant beyond belief. So apparently, but what happened at the NATO summit in London was the press asked Trump about it because it's obviously big news.
I've never seen the guy. Who?
And yet there's video, tons of video of him with Prince Andrew, and there's even pictures of him at Mar-a-Lago with Prince Andrew, and in the background there's a grinning Jeffrey Epstein. So it's amazing the alacrity with which Trump lies. It's almost, he's actually...
Well, I mean, this is no, we point these things out, but I mean, let's go back to the inaugural crowd, and we knew what we were dealing with on that day forth. His crowds were the biggest in history, and you could see with your own eyes that the Obama crowd, I mean, there were pictures that disproved it, and he didn't back down. It's straight out of Orwell. The party told you not to believe what your eyes told you, and half of his supporters do not believe their own eyes, apparently.
So will there be justice for these women who were girls when they were trafficked by Epstein, and in particularly Virginia Giuffre? She was flown to London. She had to go, according to what she said in the documentary, she had to go to a club and dance with Prince Andrew, who was the world's worst dancer, and he was sweating profusely. And then she had to go back to Epstein's place and have sex with Prince Andrew. And it was a gruesome experience. So that's her testimony. But the lawyer that's representing her, David Boies, was incriminated in a recent New York Times story, which was pretty bizarre. So given that the death of Epstein essentially made everything in Epstein's safe inadmissible because he's dead, apparently what Epstein was doing was collecting blackmail on all of these powerful men, and I don't know who was the beneficiary of his blackmailing, but the contents of that safe, which is effectively in the hands of William Barr, will never see the light of day. Is that your understanding?
Well, I mean, I do think that it will probably never see the light of day, at least not in any reasonable amount of time. Now, that article that you alluded to in the New York Times is about some shady cyber security expert who approached the Times and apparently approached the lawyers for the girls, including David Boies, with a claim that he had access to all this encrypted, blackmail material that was Epstein, that he had done cyber security for Epstein and had access to it. And he was trying to pawn it off on the Times, and then he took it over to David Boies, and Boies and his partner had cooked up some kind of scheme where they were going to take the material to the powerful men individually and, like, cut some kind of deal where they wouldn't release it, but they would get some money, and then that money would go 40% to the lawyers and, I guess, the rest of it to the girls. And then the whole deal fell apart, according to the Times article, when this shady character, who's not even named in the article, calls them up the day he's supposed to hand it over and says, "Oh, there's been a fire and everything's been destroyed in my office, and it's somewhere overseas." So you don't know who he is, where this happened, or, but the Times published it, opening more questions than answers. Now, your question is, will the girls ever see justice? It depends on your definition of justice. I mean, to me, Virginia Giuffre has been an excellent warrior for justice for herself and for, by extension, these other women, because she's been so adamant about getting the story out there. And, you know, let's remember that Jeffrey Epstein's suicide occurs within 24 hours of a giant document dump from a New York court in which the documents had to do with Giuffre suing the madam, Epstein's madam, Maxwell, and Prince Andrew's friend, Ghislaine Maxwell, for saying that Giuffre was a liar. And that case went on for years. It was undercover. It was under a gag seal. And Maxwell apparently in the end settled it. And now the documents were being released, and I went through them. There were 1,000 pages of documents. Some of it was not. The sentence would end, and you didn't know then something unrelated would start. So you knew they had taken a lot of things out. But in that dump, you had new men's names, new names of men who had not been named before, who had been supposedly at Epstein's having sex with these girls, and they included George Mitchell, the former Middle East negotiator for Clinton and former Senate Majority Leader. You had Bill Richardson, who was Clinton's energy secretary. All of these names had suddenly come out. And then within 24 hours, Jeffrey Epstein is dead. That event was directly related, in my view, with the dumping of these 800 or 1,000 pages of documents related to this case that Giuffre brought against Maxwell. So she's been fierce in claiming for justice, in claiming that she's telling the truth. And this this video from the UK the last few days of her sticking to her guns is just more evidence of that. So I think that in some ways she's already getting justice, because the royal family has basically fired Andrew as much as they can fire him from his duties. He's still the prince. He's still a member of the royal family. But that's a problem for the Brits to figure out. Why do you have monarchs? Why do you have people who are showered with inherited wealth and grievously, deeply corrupt? I mean, the video, I recommend all your listeners to go to YouTube and watch Prince Andrew being interviewed by this excellent BBC interviewer, in which he sits there and with this lockjaw aristocratic accent just spews the most insane and inane and unapologetic just blather. It's an amazing spectacle, and that's why he had to go, because you see it and you realize this man is corrupt to the core. And he has been engaged with people who are corrupt to the core, like Jeffrey Epstein. And had Giuffre not come forward, that would not have happened. So I think that they are getting a certain kind of justice. I don't know. I'm not one of those women. I've not been through an experience like that. I don't know what your definition of justice is when your younger self has been abused and trafficked. I don't know how trafficked women get justice. I don't know what the definition of justice is for them. But as a spectator to this hideousness, I think we can agree that there is a certain amount of justice, certainly in sort of the social realm. There is a justice in a worldly sense to see this man, this prince, being taken down. The problem is I don't know how many other men have not been taken down who were involved. And of course, Jeffrey Epstein himself, we will never know what he was doing and what, you know, why is Ghislaine Maxwell still running around free? I mean, Ghislaine Maxwell, if you look at the documents, the hundreds of pages of documents in that defamation case, the reason she had to settle is that there are numerous women, not just Giuffre, but numerous women, all telling the same story of this British aristocrat wandering onto, let's say, for in one example, the campus of a you know, fourth tier Christian college near Palm Beach, with supposedly looking for someone to do some work at this big estate that she ran. And of course, if you're just a kid, you know, 18-year-old Christian college girl, and you see this woman speaking the Queen's English, asking you, you know, telling you that you could get a job, you go with her. And that's what they did.
Now, she is an incredibly evil person to my mind. But again, I'm speaking with Nina Burley.
And still wandering free.
Yeah, she was having a hamburger across the street from where I'm talking to you. That's the last time she was seen at the In-N-Out Burger here in North Hollywood. So what's going on then with the case that was before the Southern District, and of all people that was handling the case for the girls, prosecuting Epstein, was none other than Comey's daughter Maureen. But with Epstein's death, they had to close the case. But Maureen Comey said she was still going to fight for the girls. So what's going on with this case? Is it dead? And by extension, therefore, all of the blackmail material that this blackmailer Epstein had kept on all of his friends, and apparently got the girls to film them as well. So whoever he was working for or whoever was funding him had a treasure trove of blackmail. But I'm really interested to know, is there any way that that could ever be surfaced, or is the case, the federal case, completely closed?
Well, I'm going to have to say that I don't know the answer to that. My understanding was immediately after he died, the Fed said, this will not end our investigation. Mm-hmm. That's what they said immediately after he died. I don't know how they continue the investigation. As you said, they have all this evidence from his safe. They have, you know, they have leads on where he was getting his money. They certainly have witnesses. They have Ghislaine Maxwell, who they could call in and interrogate. They have his associates. They have records, I'm sure, financial records. I'm sure he was doing a good job of hiding those financial records, but it's all very murky. And, you know, that's what subpoenas are for, and that's what investigators are for, and that's what the FBI is for. And so one hopes that they're maintaining their, you know, vigilance in trying to uncover what happened here. But let's just, you know, remember, I mean, we're living in a society where, unfortunately, women are treated pretty poorly. I mean, we're now in a situation where we're going to see whether the American public is even willing to elect or nominate a female again for president, because of the last round was an epic spectacle of misogyny. That election, that campaign, the Trump campaign, whatever else it was an absolute epic. Spectacle of misogyny, which I witnessed up close at the Cleveland nomination. You know, so this is, it's from the top down, and, you know, women are trafficked all the time, and they get, when men are caught involved in it, let's say the football team owner and buddy of Trump and the other donors to Trump who were down there in Palm Beach frequenting the trafficked women in that Chinese spa, that's all just been shoved under the rug. I mean, they had videotape of those guys, remember? They had videotape of them. That's all been shoved under the rug. So, you know, it's all just a big game of the powerful against the powerless, and women are relatively powerless in these situations. Now, the Me Too movement, you know, this eruption of anger, and directly related, I think, to the election of Donald Trump, has altered that algorithm, let's say, a little bit. So, you know, you do see you do see some of the mighty falling, like Weinstein or Lauer, but you still have this president who, you know, if at the very least had made an avocation of being an impresario of female flesh, a legal impresario of female flesh with the pageants, you know, the smaller bikinis, higher heels. He had his, you know, quote, modeling agency here for a while. He associated with Epstein. He associated with model agents like Casablancas, who were revealed as pedophiles later. You know, he's enmeshed in the world of trafficking, of women being trafficked around. And whether or not those are, whether they rise to the level of illegal trafficking, I don't know. But he's definitely been somebody who's moved women, herds of women around like gazelles. He's owned them. And as long as you have that kind of power structure in place, and you have his enablers like William Barr around him, and enablers who are willing to overlook this behavior as you know, anything other than criminal, because that's what it is, then we're not in a situation where there's going to be a full and thorough investigation. There are lots of female attorneys at the Justice Department, as you pointed out, Maureen Comey. You know, these women have to be agitating for this. They have to be active for it, but also people have to speak out. And the problem with the sexual abuse, these crimes, is that women are, for so long, not been willing to step up and speak about it, because they have fully, rightfully expect that they're going to be slandered and smeared for stepping up. So the Me Too movement, with all of its excesses, has actually made a huge difference in that. And women are more willing to step up. And I think we may be entering a new era, a little, you know, moving slowly forward, one step forward, two steps back for women. I mean, the insane anti-reproductive rights laws that are being passed under these Republicans, all state, in states like Ohio, this is going on every day. And there are concerted, you know, people with power, with making concerted efforts to maintain this power structure, where young women like Jeffrey, who was a foster child, treated like trash, you know, their humanity denied them, is just, you know, another day's work, another day in the life of a, you know, a Donald Trump or a Jeffrey Epstein, because they don't see these girls as having humanity.
And I'll add Prince Andrew to that list as well. And I thank you for joining us, Nina Burley. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Nina Burley, who's a national politics correspondent at Newsweek. Her book, The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, was a New York Times bestseller. And her latest book is Golden Handcuffs, The Secret History of Trump's Women.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters on the Progressive Voices channel at progressivevoices.com. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night. Just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.